Welcome to Oral Fixation. This is Andy, and we've finally reached the end of a rather eventful cycle 4 with another Q&A. Halfway through this episode, we're joined by a very special guest, so do stick around. For FYI, any audio samples we use throughout are specifically for the purposes of review and critique. Thanks for joining.
Chin. I love Hakistan. I've been there many times recently.
the GC has spoken.
And finally, we reached the end of cycle 4. But can anyone tell us that there won't be many hurdles in the future? No one can tell us that. No one knows.
Well, we already have, and we are wrapping up with, again, another hurdle, dodged, traversed, navigated, in that, because we're going to be, we're coming clean, are we?
I guess we've got to now, haven't we? We've got no choice. You've just thrown us in there.
Let the rain fall down. I'm coming clean.
So, we've got a lovely guest star. Meninsa, but what she's actually known to you guys as is at my name is not Suzanthony. Now, at my name is not Suzanthony / Meninsa / Ant Music on Twitter is a deep questioner of the pod, in that as you may remember from Q&A 3, we were like randomly going through the questions, and they're all just from him, and they're iconic questions. He's an iconic queen. He knows, she knows everything there is to know. So we invited him on from Brisbane, from Queensland, and the listeners don't need to know the details, but we basically managed to retrieve from about 50 minutes of recording about 17 minutes of salvageable material. So we're splicing that neatly on the end of this episode. So we are going to crack on with our Q&A, and then you are going to hear from our session from Meninsa towards the end. But I sort of see it as like, you know, the rest of that session might come out in, you know, years to come. Like maybe like a post, how do you say that word, which means when someone's dead? Posthumous. Like a posthumous release, sort of, you know, it might pop up on the Patreon when we're all long gone. And I think there's something quite beautiful about that.
Yeah. I mean, what, just his recording because ours didn't work, or...?
People living in the sort of virtual domain long when their souls have passed on to another dimension.
I love that. I don't know if I get it, but I love it. I love it. My mum died. Wait. I was five when my mum... What's the lyric? Come on, what's the lyric? My mum died when I was 5 years old. I love it.
love it.
Shout out to at Jan. Okay, so we've had a few questions that have come in as per. We had some other questions that were answered but have been lost in the ether, but we're going to answer some other questions now. Just a classic sort of me and Andy sparring. And then, as Andy says, we'll lead into Meninsa. So, Andy, the first question that I would like to pose to you, and I can obviously also respond, but I'm posing this one to you, comes in hot from at Hairy Witch.
Hairy Witch is a hot fan of the pod.
I think Hairy Witch might be my favorite, one of my, it's up there with my favorite Instagram.
If Hairy Witch is listening, which she is, can you please email us to tell us the origin of your Instagram handle? Because it's quite intriguing.
Give us the etymology. But Hairy Witch asks, what's a pop banger that flopped in the charts that you think should have been an enormous smash?
This question is amazing because it kind of runs through the fabric of what it means to be a gay pop fan. The gays will always be there. We know this, you know this, because if you're listening, you're likely one of them. But the gays and the girls will always be there for our divas when, let's say, the mainstream listening public have turned their backs. However, it's frustrating. I think this question is directed at when an artist is in their prime and quite rightly should be having an enormous smash. The pieces just don't somewhat add together. Maybe, I don't know, there's something in the air, maybe people are just can't stop listening to Drake. I don't know what the deal is, but the direct answer to this question would be Interview by Ariana Grande.
Was it not?
This is the thing, Drew. This is the thing. I'm so glad you answered with that, because so often gay people have no idea whether things are smashes or flops, because to them it's just a smash. And they cannot even comprehend that it's a flop. Trust me, it's a flop. Do you know what? Motivation by Normani. Flop.
What? Sorry, no. That was
technically classified as a flop. There's this incredible playlist on Spotify called Songs I Blame Straight People for Letting Flop. And it's by a guy called Matt Stapera. And I think it was actually iconically sent to me by Deep Gardener listener of the pod, Max. Oh. It's just full of smashes. 4th of July by Khalees. Black Magic by Little Mix. The sort of Paris Hilton stuff. I don't know. Dancing on My Own is a really interesting
one. You're right. I'm just looking at it now. It only got to 27 in the charts.
Is quintessentially, apart from being the single most oral fixation song, as we've discussed before, Dancing on My Own by Robin, in straight terms, was a flop. And it's taken on like this kind of mythological life for gay people and their gals. But as we all know, the Straits preferred a piano acoustic version by a pub singer. So that is just the way of the world. What is your answer?
Well, you're right. I'm just looking up now. And in the UK, Motivation only got to 27. But then I guess that's more... The bigger question for me is like, is anyone really listening to the fucking charts anymore? Like, does anyone care? But like, for all intents and purposes, it's connected to listens and record sales,
it is.
So it would
that's
still technically be
it connects a flop. Directly to like Apple Music and Spotify and stuff. So
because when I saw that question, do you know what's so weird? Well, of course, first of all, the first thing I thought when I saw that question was Lisa Scott Lee. Why did she not get top 10 with Electric? Okay, she was B-list at Capitol. You know. Anyway, but I always think
about
the only
UK TV appearance of what's his name, Walter
Mercado,
iconic. Yeah, sorry, carry on.
Iconic. Do you know who I? Like, all jokes aside, do you know who I really thought about when I saw that? For some reason, I've got this chip on my shoulder about Charlotte Church. I feel like she should have been huge, and I don't get like. Sorry, after, forget the kind of like opera, all that shit. Crazy Chick. Okay?
Do you have a soft spot for her because you went to uni in Cardiff?
I don't know, but like, I just feel like she was destined for greatness, and then we kind of never really heard of her. Do you know who else is fucking iconic? Who I don't know if you know, but I think I've sent her a few of, I've sent you a few of her songs. Her name's Dawn Richard. And then more recently, it's been stylized as Dawn.
Wasn't she off of Danity Kane?
She's off of Danity Kane. And which is, for those of you guys who don't know, which was Danity Kane was a... I think they were created in Making the Band, which was an MTV like band-making show that O-Town came out of. Maybe they... Don't quote me on that. Maybe they're just a kind of like US girl band. But anyway, Aubrey O'Day, I think, was also in Danity Kane. And Dawn Richard was one of the members of Danity Kane. They broke up yonks ago, and Dawn has gone on to like have, I think 5 or 6 albums, but they all slap. They are so good. And I went to go and see her live, in London. God, it would have been about 3 or 4 years ago with a deep ex boyfriend of the pod who, I shan't name, in XOYO, which is like a small kind of performance venue in Shoreditch. And she was, it was not a big venue, but she had the audience as putty in her hands. And I felt like I was looking at like a world class performer, and I could not believe that she hadn't reached the stratospheric heights. But that's kind of, in a way as well, what do you think about this, Andy? In a way, if something doesn't become a huge, enormous smash, in a way that kind of endears it more to the queer community sometimes, because it's almost as if they've got this secret that they can kind of like pass on, and it becomes like, it becomes mythical and it becomes lore.
Yeah, you're right. And there's a special element of that when an artist who isn't necessarily only loved by queer people, like, for example, Khalees, when she did an album like Flesh Tone, check out cycle 2 of Oral Fixation, two. Or 1. She... That album was made for the gays, as you'd know if you listened to the episode. Now, in later gigs and tours, she's veered from that kind of disco dance song, more like back to her R&B roots. But when I saw her in concert, I'm smiling thinking about it, she like put her mic out to the audience, was like, any requests? And she hadn't done a Flesh Tone song yet, and I just screamed like a mad queen, Flesh Tone. And she was like, it's coming, baby, it's coming. And when she did it, all the gays lost their minds. So there's something special about an artist who isn't exclusively loved by the queer community doing that kind of like nod to the gays, like when they fold it into like the rest of their stuff. It's complicated, isn't it, pop music? It's complex.
It's complex. It's complex.
Next question.
Next question.
Oh my gosh, speaking about complex, how different from at Celia297? How different would your lives have been if Javine had made it into Girls Aloud?
I think this is such an iconic question, and shout out to at Celia297, aka Seals, aka deep netballer of the pod, because it's a real sliding doors moment. We all thought Javine was making it into the band.
I think I would have been straight.
That's tea, actually. Because, okay, so cast your minds back, and apologies, Aussies, because I know that this skews a little bit English, but
British.
I think it was like 2000 and British, sorry. Oh, well, let's not get into that, but okay. this skews a little British. Oh, of course, because of Nadine.
Right, okay, come on.
anyway, right, whatever. Okay, well, my ignorance aside, it was like 2002, I think, that the Girls Aloud, One True Voice Girls Aloud thing happened. It was Popstars The Rivals. Ten girls and 10 guys made it to the live shows. They all had to perform, and each week, a guy and a girl would get kicked off, ultimately making the final band. And Javine was the last. It was the current members of Girls Aloud and then Javine. And Javine had kind of been the front runner. She was this amazing singer. And I think as the weeks had gone on, she just got stronger and stronger and stronger. Anyway, then the girls get voted in. I think Cheryl gets in first. Then like Kimberly maybe. Then Nadine, because it's like obviously. Then Nicola. And then it's just Sarah and Javine left. And Sarah had kind of been like, I think maybe in the bottom two a couple of times. I can't remember how the format went, but it was like, okay, well, it's obviously going to be Javine that makes it in because she's been the front runner. And Sarah gets into the band. It was the face crack of... At that point, it was the face crack of the century because we were very early into the century. There have subsequently been further face cracks that have outshone that face crack, but that was the face crack of the century at that point.
So straight off the bat, we would not have the iconic bum note from GMTV.
We would not have the bum note from GMTV. we would not have the iconic self-penned autobiography Dreams That Glitter. We would not have Girls Aloud.
Why did Sarah write that?
Was it on the record or for the record? Yeah, Sarah was Sarah was chief copywriter.
I think Girls Aloud would have lost that kind of rocky edge that Sarah brought to the band. She was sort of very hashtag rock chick. That was the vibe I always got.
You are joking because you know my story for that, don't you? Do you know my story with that?
I think so. Rings a bell. Go on.
Is it your story? No, I'm pretty sure it's Little Gay Joe's and my story. So when we went to go and see Girls Aloud, the reunion in 2013, I think it was like No Good Advice or Wake Me Up or something came on. And Sarah just goes, "This is for all the rock chicks out there." So you're right. She really was bringing that rock chick.
I just wanted to ask you, how different would your life have been if Javine had been in?
Well, we would never have had Javine's single Real Things, which profoundly informed my need to be sassy and back chatty at all times.
Oh, well, you would have saved a lot of people a lot of misery.
COVID probably wouldn't have happened if Javine had made it into Girls Aloud, I reckon.
Got it. Nailed it.
Yeah. It's a butterfly effect moment, you know, in time.
It is.
And if we could go back, I don't know. But I think that Girls Aloud, as they are, it was just this perfect concoction that just worked so well. I wonder if Javine had been in there, would they have been as kind of... It feels to me like Javine and Nadine, lol to the rhyme, but they were actually probably quite similar in terms of like gunning for best singer. And I wonder if there would have been a bit more kind of rivalry in that respect. Whereas with the others, everyone was just like, well, Nadine's the best singer. So... that just is what it is. We all want to get our own equal airtime, but there's kind of no competition here. Whereas Javine, I think, would have given her a run for her money, and maybe that would have caused more friction in the band. But as we know, there was already quite a lot of friction in the band anyway.
Right, speaking of equal airtime, I think we've answered that question. I think that one's really neatly wrapped up now. So let's put a little bow on that one.
If anyone wants any more of my thoughts on that Javine question, please do just get in touch, because for the next Q&A, I'd be more than happy to go into specifics about sort of certain singles or years.
You could do a little Instagram live.
Yeah, happy to. Catch that on the Patreon.
Right. Okay. Hang on. I've got another one for you, Drew. I've got a secret question for you.
What?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. No, come on then. We have to give this a bit of context. So when we were recording with My Name Is Not Suzanthony, Andy very sweetly at the end of the recording, which is now lost, posed a secret question to me that was asked to me by my mum. She'd sent it. Had you reached out to her or had she sent it in, Andy?
I reached out to her. Via iconic third member of the pod, Shah Tweds.
Shah, yeah. Fourth after My Name Is Not Suzanthony.
Correct, yeah.
Well, and the Slady. And anyway, look, let's not get into it. So I was completely taken aback by this amazing question that my mum asked me, and I ended up getting quite emotional because it was such a lovely question. And as luck would have it, then the whole kind of spontaneity of being asked that question was lost due to reasons we've already discussed. But I just thought it was such a lovely question, and I felt so bad for my mum for it being lost. So I've asked Andy to ask it to me again, and I think I'll try and give as similar a response as I was going to. Just, I guess, without the spontaneity and probably the emotion. But I just didn't want it to go unasked and sort of lost from the airways forever. So with that, Andy, I'll pass over back to you to ask me the secret question.
Right. Okay. So this surprise question is, first of all, coming from at Mama Tweds, deep birther of the pod. And the question is, knowing you both come from homes that loved and played a variety of music throughout your upbringings, albeit not from my influence in Andrew's case, that was all down to his father, exclamation mark. I'd love to know your inheritance tracks. Which song do you cherish from your childhood, and which song would you pass on to a future generation?
Sorry, I'm just stealing myself. I'm just stealing myself from the tears. I can't believe it. That's such an amazing question. Thank you, Mum. No, in all honesty, thank you, Mum, because it is such a great... I can imagine her receiving her... picking up her phone, seeing it's you, and just being like, oh, God, what's this going to be? And...
she would never think that when she saw my name. Ever.
But sending such an amazing question really, really is just so wonderful. And she's right. I definitely, no offence, Mum, but I definitely didn't get any of my taste from her because, as her, per her own admission, the only music that she brought into the house was probably Cliff Richard. Mm-hmm. But she is also right that my dad filled the house and the car with music from, basically from the early 60s till the early 90s. The past 30 years, when I was a child, I just had this catalogue of music from the past 30 years that I would just be continuously educated on. And so because of that, I've got such a great Rolodex of kind of references. And when Mum originally posed, when Andy posed that question to me from Mum, I said that I just gave a big shout out to my dad for kind of instilling that information into my mainframe, but shouting out three specific songs. The first was Ichiku Park by Small Faces, which is a huge family track to us, which just reminds me of long summer drives and kind of dancing around in the car and in the kitchen. A really, really big song that I've mentioned already on the pod as one of my favourites is Wicked Game by Chris Isaak, which I loved when... it's kind of scared me when I was younger, and now it kind of haunts me as well because of the fact that my dad's no longer with us, but it's just got this amazing kind of feeling sad at the beach twang that I love so much and that has made my appreciation for Lana Del Rey even greater. But then finally, the other song that I mentioned is one that I used to hate when I was younger, which is a song called Dance the Night Away by the Mavericks. And then I said, I can't remember, had you heard it, Andy?
I have heard it, yeah.
Yeah. It's very hetty, a bit of a one-hit wonder.
I heard it because I was alive in 1998.
God, to live through my 40s again. Anyway, it reminded me so much of like my parents being drunk and me being like not allowed to join the party if they were having like a dinner party. And I kind of, it just made me feel really anxious. But now that I'm not that little sort of 10-year-old boy, I look back and think of it with such fond memories for a time that can't kind of be brought back, and I'm very thankful for it. So there's my really spontaneous answer. Andy, forgive me, did you answer this as well, didn't you?
I did, yes. I said I Have a Dream by ABBA is a huge one because it is, I mean, most of my dad's music we've actually already covered on this iconic podcast, Elton John, Queen, so on so forth. But ABBA was Mum's and is Mum's, and a big part of why I think ABBA, Mum loved ABBA is because of my granddad. So her dad was this really gruff, I mean, he died when I was 5, so I do have memories of him, but I just remember him being a bit grumpy all the time. And if I asked my mum about that, she'd be like, yeah, he was. But his favourite ABBA song was Chiquitita. And my granddad was a Scottish man who'd worked down the mines, and he was just... he was the definition of, like, 60s hettiness. So to hear him kind of love one of the more sentimental, cheesy, but really quite moving songs by a sentimental, cheesy pop band is really special to me. And I really love that song. I objectively just adore that song. It's top 3 ABBA by far. And yeah, I think we talked about it before. So that's what I'll be taking from my past to my future. That is, if we even have kids, because will there even be...
Well, no, but you can also... You can also pass them on to iconic nieces or soon future nephews of the pod.
Or just friends. Like, just...
Friends!
Like me in the street. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Rightio. Well, I think that was a nice little sort of amuse-bouche to the main course of this Q&A banquet. And we are going to lead quite neatly into about half an hour of chat, tea time with Tati. And my name is not Suze Anthony / Melinsa. We say his name so much in this podcast. If we removed all the times that we said his name, we'd lose about 25 minutes. So it's an iconic name. I have no regrets about that. But yeah, Drew, is there anything you wanted to say about Melinsa, or shall we just let the track speak for itself?
Just that I think it's worth bearing in mind that he's a friend of Andy's. I'd never met him before. And I was just so struck with how he was a perfect, perfect guest, and I'm so glad that we got him on. So I hope that you guys enjoy listening to our Q&A with Melinsa. Here we go.
Yes.
Okay.
Although I'm actually drinking a white.
Okay. Yeah, we're both on white. What are you drinking?
I'm having a rosé tonight. Yeah.
Oh, fab. Okay.
Because I was feeling a little bit nervous. I've never been on a podcast before. So this is exciting and thrilling and kind of terrifying at once.
I know for a fact that's not true. My name is not Susan Anthony, because the reason, maybe you haven't been on a podcast vocally, but you dominated our last Q&A. Which is the reason we've invited you to join us on the airwaves tonight.
Yeah, you basically, you have been on Oral Fixation.
Yeah, you're the third. You know how, like, in Sex and the City, they say that New York's, like, the fifth girl? You're on New York.
I love that, except that New York in this case is Brisbane.
Yes.
So there
you
go.
Yes. Seamless. There you go. Perfect. So you're actually in Brisbane proper, or
yes,
in the burbs?
Yes.
Whereabouts are you? Actually, you don't need to put this out into the public.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in Brisbane right now, and it's kind of cold, but kind of not. So I'm wearing my Carly Rae Jepsen hoodie to stay warm. So I have had a costume change, Andy, since the sound check. And but I'm wearing shorts and slippers, so that's kind of the vibe.
Like any true artist, you changed costumes from the soundtrack to the live performance.
Yeah, well, you know, I've got to lip sync for my legacy, right?
Absolutely. Who's going to be this week's secret lip sync assassin? We don't know. One question I have for you boys. So my name is not Susan Anthony. This is the first time that we've ever met, let alone been on a podcast together. But you and Andy have met. Can you tell us a little bit about how it came to be?
We first met virtually on Twitter, and then in person we were at a Danny Minogue concert, because we are both big fans of the people's Minogue.
What's the noun for a fan of Danny? Fannies?
I've always said Stanny. I've always said Stanny Life. So yeah, so we met at a Danny Minogue concert. But we met at a at the Greyhound, which I believe is now no longer a gay venue in Melbourne, but at the time was one of the peak gay venues. Yeah, and so she was doing a little warm-up gig there before her culture club.
So it didn't go straight.
Oh, what a shame. Yeah, it was a good little venue. I really liked it. Yeah, yeah. So we met briefly there on the dance floor, and it was and she did such a great show. She was just in such fine form and living for all the gays that were there for her. So yeah, we had a it was a good night. We I didn't stay with you because Andy had a spot right down the front, and there was some you know I just came down to say hello, and then I went back to my spot because. You know, when you're at a gig, you can't just kind of barge your way down to the front like that. You have to kind of respect the boundaries that people have. And there was some demarcation. So, yeah, I took a few steps back.
You were ahead of your time. I have never barged in front of anyone at a concert. Ever. I would never.
You're actually, incredibly polite to your own detriment sometimes.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm. I might as well just not go to the concert because I just hate it being there. Yeah. Now, that was a lovely memory. And that was also, I think, the year when Danny was just doing it for the gays. I think she did a Sydney Mardi Gras performance. She did an iconic Manchester Pride performance. She supported Culture Club on tour.
Was this because the gays might have been the only ones sort of left?
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, sorry. That's on me. That's my bad. Okay, so next question. Here's one. Okay, here's one from your. I don't know if you're friends with her or you certainly know her and you referenced her earlier. Why do you think artists? This is from Slady Diana. Mm-hmm.
Noted, long-standing friend,
deep friend,
mm-hmm. pod. Sister of the pod.
This is a long one. So strap yourself in, which is actually, I think, what Slady says to most guys just before she asks them a question. Why do you think artists like Mariah, Celine, and Cher are embraced by young millennials/Gen Z, while Madonna is paid mother dust by the same group? Mariah, Cher and Celine, as examples of artists from the old guard Madonna is part of, have all had their successes in infiltrating internet culture by generating Instagram hype and becoming meme fodder, whilst Madonna has not. Discuss.
Very interesting.
Now, Mininsa, I want you to answer this first because obviously we have... Actually, first of all, let's ask you, what's your relationship with Madonna? Are you... She wasn't...
No,
in
the
top five,
I used to love her so much. And we went through a period where we stopped talking for a while. And I think... But I mean, I'd like... During the 80s and 90s, she was, you know, untouchable. She was just absolutely in her imperial period. And oh my God, like... I remember when Erotica came out, I was just obsessed with that record because it's so queer. It's so beautiful and so kind of experimental as well. I really, really love that record. Gosh, I think maybe...
Their nips, not just the tips.
Maybe in the same way that, you know, like I can imagine a... Like, if you were going to do a Snatch Game character, I could imagine you doing a Mariah or a Whitney or a Celine, and they have been done really well. But with the Madonna, she's such a massive personality on record, but to try to do that in person is quite a different thing. And in a concert setting, she's absolutely magnetic, but... Maybe as a character, like when you see her online and in those Instagram videos and tweets, I don't know, there's something that doesn't quite translate. That's not, you can't quite grab onto as much as those other beautiful women that you talked about. That's a tricky one. Yeah, she's such a massive figure in pop music, but not necessarily a massive personality.
I also wonder, because the thing is with that is that talking about, I think the Snatch Game is a really good example. And it's funny because the funniest things about Madonna, I think, are the times where she's been out of control and she is in a situation that is out of her control and she has a bit of a rant, or she kind of doesn't realize that the mic is on and tells someone to the left that she loathes hydrangeas. Like, those are the funny things about Madonna that kind of seep through in spite of her trying to control
the situation. Get me a fan.
Yes. Like, get me a fan. Yeah. I'm burning it. Like, those are the things that are the things that
do something else. Do my eyebrows.
Endear us to her.
Yes, iconic. Yes.
So I wonder if it might be that kind of, because as millennial, as a, I think just about a millennial, but certainly Gen Z, they can kind of see through the bullshit. I feel like Mariah and Celine and Cher nowadays do stuff with their tongues firmly lodged in their cheeks. And I think that Madonna has done stuff like that in the past, but maybe not to the same extent. And maybe now, because she's so kind of conscious of being in control, maybe, or being, because she's in control, and that's sometimes to her detriment, because we can tell she's definitely in control of her Instagram because it's so cooked.
For better
sometimes
or for worse.
Maybe that's why things haven't resonated.
And she's
so
and
much.
She.
What do you think, Andy?
I think you've both hit the nail on the head. I think the only other thing I'll add to that, then, on that vein, is I think camp is a really interesting factor here.
Yes.
Madonna clearly taps into something that gay and queer people identify with very strongly. I am a walking, living example of that. But, like, even the recent Drag Race challenge, like, she is enough of a star to have an entire challenge built around her, but she never sets out to be camp. There are moments in her career where she's explored camp. So the entire Confessions era was obviously quite camp. Vogue, Marie Antoinette at the VMAs without even a fake microphone is camp. But compared to the other artists, she doesn't build her brand on camp. And often what we end up thinking is camp was never intended to be camp with Madonna. Whereas I think the other three are very much like, oh, we don't care. We're gay icons and we'll explore that more silly, fabulous side of ourselves, which kind of ties into what you said. Whereas I don't think Madonna will ever really... She doesn't want to be the Vegas artist, and not in the sense of what Vegas has become in the last few years, where really legitimate, amazing artists have Vegas residencies. But I mean Vegas in the sense that it was used 10 years ago, where people went to Vegas to die. People went to Vegas where they had no other choice. And I think everything that made that Vegas artist, I think Maria Carey, Mariah Carey, Celine and Cher are all Vegas artists. And I mean that in a complimentary way now, but also in the older way. And Madonna is just determined to never be.
That is so funny and interesting that you mentioned Vegas, because when we were talking about camp, especially with Celine, when you said that, I thought about my friend Joe, little gay Joe, deep friend of the pod, shout out to Joe. He, a few years ago, went to Vegas and he went to see Celine Dion live. And she's actually kind of obviously very famous for her residency, but she'd had it for a couple of years and then had a break and then had returned. And the poster for her returning show was a picture of her back, and the two words that accompanied that were Celine's back.
Queen, what a queen.
Now, that is iconic and camp and self-referential and taking the piss.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if Madonna would ever do that.
That is amazing. I need that poster. I need 6X. I need it.
Okay, well, that was a tough one, Mininsa, but you nailed
Mininsa.
It.
Mininsa/Anthony. I'm just going to top up my wine. We're going to pause.
Okay, well, whilst Andy's doing that, I've got another one for
let's
you.
Let's do it.
And sorry, are you okay with being put on the spot like this?
Absolutely. Let's do it.
Love it. Okay, let's do it. So this is a good one. This is from @HannahAmyTurk. And she asks, what is your favorite queer music video and why?
Oh, man, that is such a good question. And that is so hard to nail down to just one thing.
I was thinking about this earlier.
Oh, I think Sylvester Mighty Real is pretty fabulous and yes. pretty queer. And I love how... I love Sylvester because he's so incredibly talented, but so kind of beyond ahead of his time.
100% coming to the podcast, by the way.
Yeah, but like he's just like he was just beyond gender, you know, in a way. Like that whole non-binary identity that he had was just incredible, amazing. But I also cannot help but come back to, I know I said I don't stand men, but there's Pete Burns from Dead or Alive, and there's an amazing video clip called I'll Save You All My Kisses that he and the band did. So he's basically mincing around in leather and tights in front of this high wire fence, and there's these kind of apparently straight men climbing the fence trying to kind of get at him, almost like as if they were going to gay bash him. And I just love how he's kind of repurposed in that video homophobia into homoerotica, and he's just kind of putting his middle finger up to those men behind him in the metaphorical sense. And it's just so, so gay and so queer. And Pete Burns is, again, one of those...
That's amazing.
It's brilliant. But when you think about kind of the conversations we're having about trans people and gender identity and... all of the spectrum that you can place yourself on. He was kind of pushing that conversation before we even had the language for it. And I find that incredible. And I find that Sylvester was very much about that as well. So I immediately think about those two. They're my favorite. So yeah, those would be my favorite videos.
For those who haven't seen the Sylvester video, can you kind of describe what happens in that?
It's basically him in a succession of fabulous outfits, quite glittery. There is a fan, so he does work a fan in the video, which we love. I just love that that song is so much about when he talks about "you make me feel mighty real." It's a love song. It's about meeting someone on the dance floor and the instant attraction and sex that might come with that. But it's also, I think, kind of like an affirmation to self as well. And I love that about that song. And that video is iconically set in a gay club, an empty gay club. But he does have around him these female dancers in little satin kind of roller boogie outfits doing the most fabulous energetic choreography around him. So, yeah. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful video. Oh my God. Queer icon, Sylvester. Yeah. So watch it now. Stop the podcast, watch that, then come back to the podcast.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Actually, I was just thinking, when you were just describing that, I was reminded of Diana Ross's video for Muscles.
Written by Michael Jackson.
I know.
No. Here's Drew trying to get back into Diana's good books.
I'm trying to get back into Diana's and your good books. But that to me is so... because I think it's really interesting, like, the word... describing a music video as queer can be so many kind of different things. I love that you mentioned Pete Burns. Muscles for me is, like, camp, pure kind of gay faggotry... also, like, one of my favorite queer music videos, when I first read that question, I thought to myself, what was the music video I first saw that made me think I might be queer? And I don't... forgive me for not knowing this about Australia. Did you have Robbie Williams?
Yes, they did.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So, I don't suppose you remember the Rock DJ video, but... in this video, it's Robbie Williams and he's dancing around and like stripping, and then he gets to like, he becomes naked and then he starts stripping his skin off. That bit didn't turn me on as much, but I remember watching the video and him kind of like dancing around in his pants with like a tiger on the crotch, just thinking, that's it, signed, sealed, delivered, I'm gay.
Yeah.
What's your favorite queer music video, Andy, and why?
I think Not necessarily my favourites of all time, but I'm reminded of in the last couple of years, we've had some amazing queer music videos. Mm. And I think about people like Troye Sivan with, song? Bloom. Before Bloom.
My.
That the video for that, I remember watching it and thinking I was witnessing a new generation of gay pop star.
Yeah.
This young-ish gay man, boy, dressed incredibly with this banger of a song, just looking like he was just literally living his best life and being so outwardly proud of his queerness. And that was so amazing to see. And on the same, by that same token, I've got to say, shout out to Tongue by MNEK, which I believe came out in the same year and in the UK, and just very differently, but similarly depicted this very sexy queer relationship, a dalliance, a tryst, on a mainstream music video. And it's amazing when you watch those videos because you get lost in the video and you just watch it as we're supposed to watch it. And then your brain reminds you that this is actually revolutionary and innovative and weird. And that's another layer of enjoyment for me. Yes. So that's my response.
That's your take. And we invite all of the listeners to slide into our DMs and tell us what their favorite queer music video is and why.
Well, it's Vogue, isn't it? So
we've done that this episode, doll. We got it out of the way early this time. Andy, would you like to ask the next question?
Yeah, okay, let's go with the cheery one. What is your go-to song when you really want to wallow in misery? Ooh. By @LiamJohn86. I'd find this difficult to answer initially, so this is over to you, Anthony.
Okay, I tend to like really up tempo, happy, life affirming pop music and dance music. So it's hard for me to get into that place where I would wallow, but I do love a Whitney Houston ballad or Cool Down, if we're talking about the greatest hits disc. And specifically, I think Didn't We Almost Have It All is one of my very, very favorites. It's about kind of having the best night of your life, the best moment, and it was almost perfect. And that you'll never get that back again. And I just find that so beautiful and heartbreaking. And especially when you think about...
I've actually never heard that song before.
Oh, yeah. It was like... I think it was the last single of the Whitney album in 1988. It's brilliant. It's a very old-fashioned song. It's written by Michael Massa, who did some of Diana's 70s ballads as well. So Drew may not like it, but it's very good.
Well, on that note, before we go on to Drew, I think you've reminded me of Whitney's most recent / last album has a very special place in my heart because it's an incredible example of a legendary artist who'd fallen from grace, and then her entire support team rally around her to try and get her to, you know, to return to her greatness. And there's something still there. So the concerts she was doing at the time were just destroyed in the press, and both in Australia and the UK, audiences would just walk out because her voice was ripped to shreds. She was so unprofessional.
I went to that really concert, sad, Andy. And it was, she was like, the voice was not great, but I was just so excited that I was getting to see Whitney Houston live. Like, because even though the voice was not, I remember when she tried to do I Will Always Love You, and there was a moment where, you know, there's that big note at the end, and she kind of turned it back to the audience. And she was she had a drink, she patted her face down, and she was kind of almost steeling herself to like, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this. And then she turned around and she did it. And the voice wasn't able to do it, but she, oh my God, she wanted to do it so badly. And I just like, I loved it. And even though it was absolutely panned by the Australian press, and, you know, it probably wasn't a great concert, I just was absolutely mesmerized by her. I could not take my eyes off her. And I was in, I think, in row 8. I kept running down to the front. I just kept being drawn to her. I just could not stop myself. I just kept running down to the front just to, like, bathe in her Whitney-ness. And then the security would send me back. And they'd say, if you keep coming down here, we're kicking you out. And I kept doing it anyway. And I was just, oh my God, I was absolutely mesmerized by her. Even though the voice wasn't there, the charisma was out of control. Absolutely out of control. If I wake up in World War III. No, I have no. Thank you for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure. I feel like I'm a deep friend of the Podtina Aurelina Fixatius III, and it has been an absolute pleasure to be here tonight with you. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's such a treat. I can't believe it.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Meninsa. That is so sweet, and it's been such a pleasure and a treat having you join us on the podcast. Before we head into our final little piece of bonus content, because I believe you've got a story for us about the time that you met a certain icon that we are all obsessed with, I'll just do a quick wrap up and then we can head into your story. So, guys, thank you so much for listening. If you have enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe and rate and review. If you'd like to follow Anthony, my name is not Suze Anthony, then you can do. He's at my name is not Suze Anthony on Instagram and Ant Music on Twitter, I believe. If you'd like to follow Andy, you can. He's at Andrew, do you think you are? Huge news. If you'd like to follow me, I've had an Instagram rebrand. So if you'd like to follow me, you can now find me at With All Drew Respect. I've been trying to find a good pun name to rival Andy's for a long time, and I think I've got there with this one. So I'm at With All Drew Respect, with full stops between each word, on Instagram. Our Spotify playlist for this episode will be full of Whitney and Cookery. Celine and more Whitney and some more Celine. You can follow us on Instagram at Oral Fixation Podcast. Email us oralfixationpodcast@gmail.com. Andy, do you have anything more to say before we head pass back over to Meninsa?
No, other than that, if you're still with us, you'll be glad because, yes, like Drew said, this is a fascinating story of how our guest met someone who we are obsessed with. And he kind of just really casually tagged it on when he thought that the mics had stopped recording. And I think it's all more special for that. So enjoy a little bit of Patreon bonus content for free. No need to sign up to Patreon for this one. Other than that, I'm good. So we'll see you in 2 weeks.
With all that said, Meninsa, let's hand it back over to you, Joe.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So in five years ago, and have we got time for this? Okay. All right. Okay. Bonus content. Okay. So 5 years ago, I went on a work trip to New York. And while I was there, I was tweeting that I was in New York. And then RuPaul tweeted me back. And then he sent me a DM to say, because we follow each other on Twitter and we've kind of built up quite a rapport over the years because I love talking about music and he really loves talking about music. And so through Twitter, we swapped numbers in New York and then my phone went off and when I was in New York and I went, hello. And then on the other side of the phone, I heard something like, oh, what was it? It was like, how the bloody hell are ya? How you going? It was RuPaul on the other side of the phone. And I went, hi, RuPaul, how are you? And this was All Stars 2 had just been filmed, but we didn't know it was coming out. It was like, so when was that? I don't know. I don't know how many. But this was 2020? So it was 2015. Yeah, so it was September 2015. And yeah, so he came to my hotel. Because we made a time to have breakfast together. He came to my hotel, picked me up, walked through the foyer doors, and I was kind of like, there were these glass, there's this kind of glass section where you can see the entry, and the person can't see you, but you can see them entering. And he walked through the door, and I was thinking, oh my God, RuPaul's walking through the door. And then he walked into the foyer and he saw me, and we hugged and kissed, and he turned to me and said, okay, so what's good for breakfast around here? And I went, I don't know. But we walked out of the hotel and we just started chatting, and we didn't stop chatting for about 3 hours. So we had brunch at a little cafe near his house, and we basically talked about music nearly all of the time. He'd keep saying, he'd say, oh, do you know this Barry Gibb song? Or do you know this Donna Summer song? And then he'd play it to me on the phone, and I'd go, oh my God, that's so good. And I'd write it down quickly. But we had the best time to, honestly, he gave me the ultimate fan experience. I had a brunch with him. He chatted with me. He asked me about my life. He was deeply interested in me as a person, not just as a fan. And he asked me about my partner, what I do for work, what I do for fun. Honestly, he was a prince of a guy, an absolute prince of a guy. And he gave me the best fan experience possible. I can't even imagine anything better, honestly. And then at the end of it, we walked down to the piers, which were pretty significant in Paris is Burning and, in 80s and 90s New York gay culture, because that's where all the sex happened. And so we were just standing there on the pier chatting together, and then he played me a song from his Christmas album that was coming out at that time, which was called Sleigh Bells. And so he played me one of the songs from that, and I was going, oh my God, that's so good, Ru. it was just brilliant. And I even got the opportunity to say to him, look, thank you so much for all the joy you've given me. You've unlocked so much love and happiness in my heart through what you've done. And he was really lovely. He accepted that compliment he was really touched in his way, because, you know, even though he's a very public person, he's also kind of very strongly private and very interior in his way. So he was, to meet someone you love and to be able to tell them how much their art has impacted on you and how much you've gotten from that, and for them to go, oh, okay, yeah, that's, yeah, okay, I have made a difference. Then we went back to the hotel and had a little chat in the cab on the way about Golden Girls, his work ethic. At that time, the 20th anniversary of Showgirls, the movie. And then we hugged goodbye, and he got on his bike and drove off into the sunset. And yeah, that is the very short version of a very long story. But really, really lovely man who took such good care of me, like you did tonight. So thank you. Legends only.